Chapter 2. The Siege of the City. Amuba saw his father fall, and leaping from his chariot, strove to make his way through the mingled mass of footmen and chariots to the spot. Jethro followed close behind him. He too had caught sight of the falling figure, and knew what Amuba did not, that the Rebu had lost their king. He reached Amuba's side just in time to interpose his shield between the boy and an Egyptian archer in a chariot he was passing. The arrow pierced the shield and the arm that held it. Jethro paused an instant, broke off the shaft at the shield, and seizing the point, which was projecting 2 inches beyond the flesh, pulled the arrow through the wound. It was but a moment's work, but short as it was, it almost cost Amuba his life, for the archer, leaning forward, dropped the end of his bow over the lad's head, a trick common among the Egyptian archers, and in a moment dragged him to the ground, while his comrade in the chariot raised his spear to dispatch him. Jethro sprang forward with a shout of rage, and with a blow of his sword struck off the head of the spear as it was descending. Then he sprang into the chariot, ran through the body the man holding the bow, and grappled with the spearman. The struggle was a short one. Leaving his sword in the body of the archer, Jethro drew his dagger and speedily dispatched his foe. Then he jumped down and, lifting Amuba, who was insensible, carried him back to his chariot and with the greatest difficulty managed to draw him out of the heat of the conflict. The Rebu, who had seen the fall of their king, had dashed forward to rescue the body and to avenge his death. They carried his body to the rear, through the chaos of plunging horses, broken chariots, and fiercely struggling men. Then it was placed in another chariot, and the driver started with it at full speed for the city. Jethro, on emerging from the crowd, saw at once that the battle was lost. He ran up to 2 mounted men, badly wounded, who had, like himself, made their way out of the fight. "In a quarter of an hour," he said, "a new causeway will be completed, and the Egyptians will pour over. In that case, resistance will be impossible, and all will be lost. One of you ride to each flank and tell the captains that the king is dead, that there are none to give orders here, and that their only chance to save their troops is to retreat at full speed to the city while keeping good order." The horsemen rode off immediately. Jethro returned to his chariot and at once drove off. Amuba was now recovering.
What is it, Jethro? What has happened?"
"The battle is lost, Prince, and I am conveying you back to the city. You have had a rough fall and a narrow escape of your life."
"And the king, my father?" Amuba said, struggling to his feet. "What of him?"
"I know naught of him for certain. There was a terrible fight raging, and as I had to carry you out, I could take no share in it. Besides, I had an arrow through my left arm. If I had been a moment later, it would have gone through your body instead. And now, if you do not mind taking the reins, I will bandage it up. It is bleeding fast, and I begin to feel faint."
This was indeed true, but Jethro had called Amuba's attention to his wound principally for the sake of diverting his thoughts for a moment from his fear for his father. As Amuba drove, he looked back. The plain behind him was covered with a mass of fugitives.
"I see that all is lost. But how is it that we are not pursued?"
"We shall be pursued before long," Jethro answered. "They are making a fresh causeway, and when that is completed, those who cross will take up the pursuit."
"Surely our men ought to retreat in good order, Jethro. Scattered as they are, they will be slaughtered by the Egyptian chariots."
"They could not oppose much resistance to them anyhow. On a plain, footmen cannot withstand a chariot charge. Many will doubtless fall, but numbers will reach the hills in safety. The new causeway is narrow, and a few only can cross abreast, and thus I trust that the greater part of our men will escape."
"Let us draw up here for a short time, Jethro. I see there are several chariots and some horsemen behind. Let us join them and proceed in a body to the town. I should not like to be the first to enter with the news of our defeat."
A score of chariots presently came up, and all halted on seeing Amuba. One of them contained Amusis, the chief captain of the army. He leaped from his chariot when he saw Amuba and advanced to him.
Prince, he said, why do you delay? I rejoice at seeing that you have escaped in the battle, but let me beg you to hasten on. A few minutes and the Egyptian chariots will be upon us.
I am ready to proceed, Amusis, since you have come. Have you any news of my father?
The king has been sorely wounded,
the general said,
and he was carried off out of the battle. But come, prince, we must hasten on. Our presence will be sorely needed in the city, and we must get all in readiness for defense before the Egyptians arrive.
As the party entered the town, they found confusion and terror prevailing. The arrival of the body of the king was the first intimation of disaster, and this had been followed by several horsemen and chariots who had spread the news of the defeat of the army. During the drive, Amusis, who had driven in Amuba's chariot, had broken to the boy the news that his father was dead, and Amuba was prepared for the loud lamentation of women which met him as he entered the royal enclosure. I will see my mother, he said to Amusis, and then I will come down with you to the walls and will take whatever part you may assign me in the defense. It is to your experience and valor we must now trust.
I will do all that I can, prince. The walls are strong, and I trust we may be able to defend ourselves successfully against the Egyptian host. Assure your royal mother of my deep sympathy for her in her sorrow, and of my devotion to her personally.
The general now drove off, and Amuba entered the royal dwellings. In the principal apartment, the body of the king was laid upon a couch in the middle of the room. The queen stood beside it in silent grief, while the attendants raised loud cries, wrung their hands, and filled the air with their lamentation, mingled with praises of the character and bravery of the king. Amuba advanced to his mother's side. She turned and threw her arms around him.
Thank the gods, my son, that you are restored to me. But what a loss, what a terrible loss is ours.
It is indeed, mother. No better father ever lived than mine. But I pray you lay aside your grief for a while. In a few hours the Egyptian hosts will be before our walls, and every arm will be needed for their defense. I am going down to take my place among the men, to do what I can to encourage them. But the confusion in the city is terrible. None know whether they have lost husbands or fathers, and the cries and lamentations of the women cannot but dispirit and dishearten the men. I think, mother, that you might do much, if you would.
What would you have me do?
I should say, mother, that you could mount a chariot and drive through the streets of the town, bid the women follow the example of their queen, and defer their lamentation for the fallen until the foe has been repelled. Bid each do her part in the defense of the city. There is work for all, stones to be carried to the walls, food to be cooked for the fighting men, hides to be prepared in readiness to be carried to the ramparts to shield our soldiers from arrows.
Your advice is wise, Amuba. I will follow it. Order a chariot to be brought down. How did you escape from the conflict?
Jethro bore me off, mother, or I too should have fallen. And now, with your permission, I will go to the walls.
Do so, Amuba, and may the gods preserve you.
The scene from the walls was a heart-rending one. All over the plain were scattered groups of men hurrying towards the city, while among them dashed the Egyptian chariots, overthrowing and slaying them. But not without resistance. The Rebu were well disciplined, and as the chariots thundered up, little groups gathered together, shield overlapping shield and spears projecting, while those within the circle shot their arrows or whirled stones from their slings. Thus, although many fell, many succeeded in gaining the gates of the town. Although the Egyptian chariots came up in great numbers, night fell without the appearance of the main body of the Egyptian army. After darkness set in, great numbers of the Rebu troops who had escaped to the hills made their way into the town. Before morning, the 6,000 men left behind to guard the city when the army set out had been swelled to 4 times their numbers.
Although this was little more than half the force which had marched out to battle, the return of so large a number caused a great abatement of the panic and misery that had prevailed, and the example of the queen had already done much to restore confidence. In the morning, all collected at the trumpet call. Weak battalions were joined to the strong, fresh officers were appointed to take the place of those who were missing. The arms were examined, and all deficiencies made good from the public stores. 10,000 men were set aside as reserve to be brought up to the points most threatened, while to the rest were allotted those portions of the wall which they were to occupy. As soon as morning broke, the women recommenced the work that had been interrupted by night, making their way to the walls in long trains, carrying baskets of stones on their heads. Even the children joined in the work, carrying small baskets of earth to those portions of the wall which Amusis had ordered to be strengthened. The position of the city had been chosen with a view to defense. It stood on a plateau of rock raised some 50 feet above the plain. The Caspian washed its eastern face. On the other three sides, a high wall, composed of earth roughly faced with stones, ran along at the edge of the plateau. Above it, at distances of 50 yards apart, rose towers. The town had never been taken, although several times besieged, and the Rebu had strong hopes that they could oppose a successful resistance to all the efforts of the enemy. At noon, the Egyptian army was seen advancing, and confident as the defenders of the city felt, they could not resist a feeling of apprehension at the enormous force which was seen upon the plain. The Egyptian army was over 300,000 strong, with mercenaries from every tribe and people with whom the Egyptians had any dealings. The Egyptians were divided according to their arms. There were regiments of archers who carried for close combat a slightly curved stick of heavy wood. Other regiments of archers carried hatchets. The heavy infantry all bore the Egyptian shield, which was about 3 feet long. It was widest at the upper part, where it was semicircular, while the bottom was cut off straight. Some regiments carried, in addition to the spears, heavy maces. Others, axes. Their helmets all fitted closely to the head. Most of them wore metal tassels hanging from the top. The helmets were for the most part made of thick material, quilted and padded. These were preferred to metal, being a protection from the heat of the sun. Each company carried its own standard. These were all of religious character, and represented animals sacred to the gods, sacred boats, emblematic devices, or the names of the king or queen. These were in metal, and were raised at the ends of spears or staves. Behind the army followed an enormous baggage train, and as soon as this had arrived on the ground, the tents of the king and the principal officers were pitched. "What a host!" said Jethro, who had accompanied Amuba to the walls. "It seems a nation rather than an army. I do not wonder now that we were defeated yesterday, but that we so long held our ground, and that so many escaped from the battle." "It is wonderful, truly, Jethro. However, although they are countless in numbers, they cannot do much against our walls. No towers that they can erect upon the plains will place them on a level with us here, and the rock is so steep that it is only here and there that it can be climbed." "It would seem impossible for them to take it, Prince. But we must not be too confident." "I doubt not that if we can resist the first onslaught of the Egyptians, we can hold out far longer than they can, for we have provisions enough to last for well nigh a year, and of wells there are abundance. The difficulty of provisioning so huge an army will be immense. In what way do you think they will attack?" "That I cannot tell you. The Egyptians are skilled in all the devices of war. They have laid siege to and captured great numbers of cities, and are doubtless full of plans and expedients of which we know nothing. However, nothing will be attempted today. The generals have first to inspect our walls and see where the assault is to be delivered, and the army will be given a day's rest at least." In the afternoon, a cortege of chariots made the circuit of the walls from the shore of the sea round the great plateau to the sea again, keeping just beyond the range of arrows.
"If we had but a few of their archers here," Jethro said, "the Egyptian king would not be so overbold in venturing so near. It is wonderful how strongly they shoot. Their arrows have fully double the range of ours, and their power is sufficient to carry them through the strongest shields, even when strengthened with metal. Had I not seen it, I should have thought it impossible that living men could have sent their arrows with such power. I regarded myself as a good bowman, till I met the Egyptians."
In the evening, the great council met. It included all the principal officers of the army, the priests, the royal counselors, and the leading men in the state. After a discussion, it was determined that in the present crisis it were best to postpone taking any steps to appoint a successor to the late king, but that so long as the siege lasted, Amusis should be endowed with absolute powers. In order that there should be no loss of time for the necessity of consulting anyone, Amuba was present with his mother at the council. At its commencement, an announcement was made in their name that they were willing to abide by whatever the council should decide. The body of the king was consumed on a great funeral pile. Under ordinary occasions, the ceremony would have taken place on a narrow promontory jutting out into the sea about 5 miles from the city. But it was impossible for the present to lay the ashes of the king by the side of those of his forefathers, and the ceremony was therefore conducted within the royal enclosure. Only the officiating priests and the wife and son of the deceased being present. When all was over, the ashes were collected and were placed in a casket, which was destined, when better times returned, to be laid in the sight of the whole people in the sacred enclosure on the promontory. Early next morning, the trumpets of the guards on the walls called all the troops to arms. As soon as Amuba reached his post, he saw the Egyptian army marching against the city. When they arrived within bowshot, the archers, who formed the front lines, opened fire upon the defenders on the walls. Their arrows, however, for the most part fell short, while those of the besieged rained down upon them with effect. They were therefore withdrawn a short distance, and contracting their ranks, a vast number of footmen poured through, and in irregular order ran forward to the foot of the rock, where they were sheltered from the arrows of those on the wall. "What can they be going to do now?" Amuba exclaimed. Jethro shook his head.
"We shall see before long."
Even above the din caused by so vast a multitude, a sharp metallic sound was presently heard, like that of innumerable hammers striking on steel. "Surely," Amuba exclaimed, "they can never be thinking of quarrying the rock away." It was nigh an hour before the mystery was solved. Then, at the blast of a trumpet, a great number of heads appeared along the edge of rock at the foot of the walls. The Egyptians had been employed in driving spikes in the crevices of the rock. Standing on the first so driven, they then inserted others 3 feet higher, and so had proceeded until a number of men had climbed up the face of the rock. These let down ropes, and ladders had been hauled up the steepest places. Great numbers of ropes were hung down to assist those who followed in the ascent, and the men who first showed themselves over the brow were followed by a stream of others, until the ledge, which was in most cases but a few feet wide, was crowded with soldiers. The ladders were now hauled up and placed against the wall, and the Egyptians swarmed up in great numbers. But the Rebu were prepared for the assault, and a storm of stones, beams of wood, arrows, javelins, and other missiles rained down on the Egyptians. Many of the ladders, in spite of the number of men upon them, were thrown back by the defenders, and fell with a crash over the edge of the rock to the plain below. Here and there the Egyptians gained a footing on the wall, but the Rebu attacked the Egyptians with such fury that in every case the latter were slain fighting or were thrown over the embattlements. For several hours the Egyptians continued their efforts, but after losing vast numbers of men without obtaining any success, they were recalled by the sound of the trumpet. The fight was not renewed until evening, when a large number of the Egyptians again ascended the rock. As before, the Rebu poured missiles down upon them, But this time, only a sufficient number had climbed up to be able to stand along close to the foot of the wall, where they were to a great extent sheltered from the missiles from above. The night was a dark one, and all night long the Rebu continued to shower down missiles upon their invisible foe, of whose continued presence they were assured by the sounds which from time to time were heard. When daylight enabled the defenders to see what was going on at the foot of their walls, they raised a shout of surprise and dismay. During the night, the Egyptians had hoisted up by ropes a quantity of timbers, which were all cut and prepared for fitting together, and were easily jointed even in the dark. Thus, then, when the besiegers looked over, they saw 40 or 50 of these shelters erected against the foot of their walls. They were so formed that they sloped down and were thickly covered with hides. So solid were these constructions that the beams and great stones which the Rebu dropped upon them simply bounded off and leaped down into the plain. Ladders fastened together had been fixed by the Egyptians from each of these shelters to the plain below, so that the men at work could be relieved or reinforced as the occasion required. In vain the besieged showered down missiles. In vain poured over the cauldrons of boiling oil they had prepared in readiness. The strength of the beams defied the first. The hides lapped over each other prevented the second from penetrating to those below. "Truly these are terrible foes, Prince," Jethro said. "I did not think that the very day after the siege began we should find that they had overcome all the difficulties of our natural defences and should have established themselves in safety at the foot of our walls. But what is to be done, Jethro? The men working in these shelters will speedily dislodge these stones facing the walls and will then without difficulty dig through the earthwork behind." "The matter is serious," Jethro agreed. "But as yet there is no reason to alarm ourselves. Should the Egyptians gain a way through, we should pour in at the openings, and as they can be only reinforced slowly, would speedily hurl them all over the edge of the cliff. It is not that that I fear."
"What is it that you do fear, Jethro?"
"I fear, Prince, because I do not know what it is I have to fear. We are as children in a struggle of this kind as opposed to the Egyptians. Already they have wholly overthrown all our calculations, and it is just because I do not know what they will do next that I am afraid. It must be as plain to them as it is to us that if they dig through the walls we shall rush in and overpower them. Well, perhaps they intend to work right and left and to undermine the walls until large portions of them tumble over and breaches are made." Jethro shook his head. "That would destroy the Egyptian shelters and bury their workmen. Or even did they manage to retire before the walls fell, they would gain nothing by it. I see now that our builders made a mistake in surrounding the city with a high wall. It would have been best to have built a bare breastwork at the very edge of the cliff all around. Here comes Amusis. We shall hear what his opinion of the matter is." Amusis looked flushed and anxious, although when he saw the prince, he assumed an expression of carelessness.
"The Egyptians are going to burrow through our walls," he said. "But when they do, we will drive them like rats out of the hold. Do you not think so, Jethro?"
"I do not know. If they dig through our walls, we shall certainly, as you say, drive them out of their holes. But I cannot believe that that is what they are going to do."
"What do you think they are going to do?"
"I have no idea, Amusis. I wish that I had. But I am quite sure that they haven't taken all this trouble for nothing."